I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between individual human well-being and everything going on in our total environment, in other words, our world. We discuss the status of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the place we are with our public policies, the condition of our society, and that of planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk with different experts, documentarians, journalists, scientists, authors, doctors, thought leaders, artists, filmmakers, activists, advocacy people, and people representing different communities and expertise on all of the interconnected areas that impact well-being and health on planet Earth. On this week's show, I am super delighted to have a playwright as the guest today. She is Karen Malpede, a playwright and also a director, the author and director of 19 plays, including a whole host of different productions that I won't go into, but just so many, it's kind of almost hard to believe. Her most recent, except for the current one, which we'll be talking about in depth, include Dinner During Yemen, a playlet written for an evening for the people of Yemen as part of a benefit in January, a futuristic drama called Other Than We. And, you know, as I think can be seen just from this brief highlight of her many titles, you know, her interests span into exactly the areas that we cover here on this show. Upcoming this week is her most recent production. It is beginning in New York and running from March 1st to 18th, and we'll be discussing more how people in the New York metro area can go see what we're going to be talking about today, which is Karen Malpede's new production of Extreme Weather, which she has called a cli-fi play that she wrote and directed. The play juxtaposes psychological and magical realism in a tale of a courageous climate researcher who is defamed by special interests, including in his own family. And for the theater buffs in our audience, the Obie winner, Rocco Sisto, heads the cast of six. So we'll be talking more about the play during this interview. And I just want to warmly welcome to Connect the Dots, and thank you so much for being with us today, Karen Malpede.
Thank you, Allison. It's my pleasure to be with you. I just wanted to say that the title Extreme Weather is spelled W-H-E-T-H-E-R. So it's a pun, it's a pun, and it's a dare. And, you know, do extreme weather or not, we face the challenges that face us right now.
Well, there couldn't be anything of greater importance, timeliness, or I dare say interest to my listeners and to me. So, you know, that's exactly where we are poised in the weather about the weather, whether, you know, enough people will face it in time to be able to do in the remaining window, which is narrowing every day, what needs to be done to protect the future of not only our own species, but many other species here on Earth. Can you tell our listeners, Karen, a little bit about how this play came into being?
Sure. I've been an eco-feminist all my life. I grew up as a stable bum, working with horses. I built a cabin in the woods with no power tools. I was part of the Women in Life on Earth movement of the 80s, early 80s, when we did a women's peace encampment, an eco encampment, and we surrounded a missile base so that they couldn't ship the missiles to Europe. We surrounded the Pentagon. We were linking obviously the destruction of war and the destruction of the planet and the kind of mindset that leads to both. But this was actually before 1988 when James Hansen went to Congress and announced that global warming had begun, that it was now measurable, which is in the play. So when I turn to wanting to write a play about global warming and began to do the research, I became inspired by the lives of major climate scientists who have been attacked and vilified. So everything that's in the play has actually happened to Michael Mann, Jim Hansen, Jennifer Francis, and others who have done groundbreaking scientific work. And I came to think of climate scientists as sort of unwilling heroes. In other words, they were doing their research, they found out what was going on, they started talking about it, and then they got this enormous pushback, and they all had to decide what to do next. And that's really what the play is about. How do you deal with a truth, a scientific truth, and make it public, and how do you deal with literally the assaults on your work, your reputation, sometimes threats against your life, et cetera.
Well, that's fascinating. And, you know, even for, you know, we talk about science and the importance of science and taking a stand for science, but many people don't really think about the fact that, you know, scientists, as much as we respect them, are human beings and have similar struggles. And, in fact, I'm sure there are many people who are not scientists who even, you know, on the simplest citizen engagement level, take action and participate in civic engagement on behalf of the climate and are met with misunderstanding by their family, by their neighbors, by their coworkers, by their bosses. And, you know, even people who are kind of educated enough to sort of recognize that this is bona fide science, routinely dismiss people who kind of step out of conformity to bring a dangerous message. You know, one is supposed to, in this country, kind of conform to, you know, a bunch of, you know, sort of community values in the communities that we live in and in our society that sort of shape what's okay and what isn't. And so stepping over that line is something that I think many of the listeners to this program and, you know, many of the people with whom I'm in regular conversation on Facebook and in other places encounter. Because what's happening with the climate is really the ultimate disruption. And, you know, as mammals, we don't like disruption. And so it's all too easy for that reason alone claiming to resist the big agendas going on in the current administration, to actually resist the people who are carrying the information and the message about all of this.
Yeah. So I'm a playwright, so I had to strategize how to tell a story that would engage a broad audience. So I did a couple of things. The play, as you said, is realism and magical realism. It goes between the conflict in the family, which is between two climate scientists, the lover of the major climate scientist and the twin sister of the major climate scientist. She's a publicist for the fossil fuel industry. She's the woman who created the I'm an Energy Voter advertising campaign. She believes in all of the above. Fracking, offshore drilling, Arctic drilling, and her husband, who's a lobbyist for the fossil fuel industry. But I set the play on the estate, the inherited land trust of the Bjornsson family, who are the scientist's family, and his daughter and uncle, who's the steward of the estate, are involved in preserving this estate and also putting up a wind turbine, making it energy independent, but also protecting the frogs who have been affected by the herbicide atrazine, which is another story in the play, which feminizes frogs and probably affects the hormonal balance of human beings as well, has been banned in the European Union, but is allowed here and is a and the scientist who did that work was also attacked. So, but what I do in the play is juxtapose these wonderful scenes in nature where people are underneath a starry sky or are building a frog pond, are just in nature, and the conflict stops because when we're in nature, something deeper happens to us. And we're at home in a way. And when that happens, I think everybody in the audience, certainly everybody in the play, feels the beauty of nature and the vanishing of nature at the same time, which we feel now. So the play is, on the one hand, a drama, a conflict between truth and lies, really, between science and money, between a way forward and a way to increase the coffers of the wealthy fossil fuel folks. So it's that conflict, and the scientists have to keep rejiggering their approach, and they become scientist activists in the course of the play. And the other hand, the play is a meditation on the beauty of nature and the poetry of nature. And so it works on both those levels and in that way engages the audience in a powerful story of conflict, but also an equally powerful meditation on the beauty that we all share and that we all know and that we all value. Whether or not we're fighting to protect it, we do value it. So that tries to reach people on a very primal level.
Oh, how absolutely brilliant is that? So, you know, isn't that interesting? Because I'll just share that in my life, I am connected to, you know, multiple communities through the places that I've lived. Some of them are rural, set in nature. Some are, you know, here in New York City where, you know, there's a lot of diversity and sense of engagement. And, you know, and it's really hard to integrate, even for people who, you know, love nature and go out, to kind of integrate that love into one's values and actions and understanding and the role we play in our world, you know, is not that easy to integrate. But through the medium of art, in a play, you know, you're able to actually create an integrated experience or a more holistic experience of these different things that pull on our feelings and loyalty and touch us so deeply. So that sounds absolutely brilliant. Can you tell the listeners a little bit more about, you know, the history of this play and, you know, where it has been, its inception was and all of that? Because I think it's a pretty fascinating story.
Sure. First of all, I just wanted to say that the characters in the play range from the age of 13 to 85. So we're really speaking generationally. The scientists are sort of in the middle there. They're middle-aged people and the fossil fuel lobbyists, too. But the young girl, Annie, and Uncle, the steward of the estate. And so Uncle remembers the old-growth forests beneath his feet. And he talks about, we painted with our words, nature interfered in everything we said. He speaks because, you know, without nature, there's also no poetry. You can't imagine poetry without nature. Poetry is the internal wilderness that we have inside of us that we pull out to express our deepest feelings, just as the wilderness outside of us allows us to feel so deeply. So Uncle remembers all of that. Annie, as she says, was born into a world where she can feel the vanishing of things. So she's the new generation, the young activists, the kids who are so brave and so fierce. On the lines, you know, doing what has to be done, fighting for their future, literally fighting for their future. So in the middle are the sort of rational folks, the scientists, and then the fossil fuel lobbyists, and the scientists coming up with a plan for a carbon tax, for instance, trying to figure out what are the public policy steps we can take to actually affect things, to reach people, reach a lot of people. So I use Jim Hansen. The play is much inspired by the story of Jim Hansen, but also Michael Mann, also Jennifer Francis, an Arctic ice scientist. Jennifer and Jim have seen the play and they love the play, and they've read it and they've seen it and they've spoken afterwards. Let me tell you the history of the play. So the history of the play was doing this research and suddenly saying, oh, my God, these people are being censored, and they're being censored by a high-power campaign that has been in this country for a long time. It's free enterprise, any kind of regulation. The same people who worked against who worked for the cigarette lobby are, you know, sort of spearheaded and put together the anti-climate science campaign. It has many of the same characteristics. This has been documented in a number of books, of course. So I thought, you know, this is an amazing story of censorship that really affects the future of all of us. This is not a story about does the sun revolve around the moon, or the earth, or does the earth revolve around the sun. It's not Galileo, because that's going to happen anyway. It doesn't matter what we think, you know. The universe functions the way the universe functions. What matters is we've disrupted the climate systems, and so the universe, the world, our world, our planet is no longer functioning the way it was functioning. And if we censor that reality, we are dooming not only ourselves, as you said, but also all the other creatures and all the other climate systems that have been working to maintain life on this planet for, you know, at least the last 10,000 years. So this is serious. If you censor not just truth, but truth that affects the well-being of life, this is, I think, the most catastrophic blockage of human knowledge ever in history. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to dramatize that, and that's what I've attempted to do and think have done. So we did the play in a series of readings, developmental readings. It was once much longer than it is now. It was a little, it's been tightened, it's been focused. Then we did it in a workshop, a very successful workshop in 2014, and Andy Revkin wrote a long article about it in his .earth blog, and Jennifer Francis and Jim Hansen were very enthusiastic, and we thought, oh boy, this play can be done, you know, all over. Well, it was done in Copenhagen, it was done in Oklahoma, it's been done in Tennessee, amateur productions, all of them. But we didn't realize the amount of censorship that exists, against any art that would also try to tell the story that the scientists did, right? So there's tremendous censorship in the theater itself. Many of the foundations, totally. And people don't understand this, but the American theater is run by money, like every other institution. And that money often comes from places that don't want certain things to be said. And certainly they don't want anything that would affect their profits to be said. Having this successful play, it's also just been published in a book of mine called Plays in Time, which is my last four plays. Anyway, having this really successful play, we did take it to Paris, and we did it during the Art COP in 2015 with an international company. We did it in French and English, just as readings, because we didn't have the money or the time during the COP itself to put on a full production. But again, we had a very wonderful reception, enthusiastic audiences. And then we had to try to figure out how we could do the play again in the United States. And from 2015 to now 2018, that's how long it took us. La Mama, which is a wonderful experimental theater venue, was courageous enough to give us another showing of the play in New York City. The play is in really tight shape now. It's been focused and honed. It has music. It has a beautiful set. It has a fantastic cast. And we are about to reopen. And it's only 12 performances. So we're hoping that people will come, that the word can spread, that we can make the play available to colleges, young people, to activist organizations. It works beautifully as a reading. It's full of information and also full of drama.
Where would people who would like to see the play during the 12-day period beginning this week, March 1st?
It's 3 weekends.
Through the 18th.
Three weekends. Yeah,
it's three weekends.
Thursday through Saturdays at 7:30, Sunday at 3. It's LaMama.org in New York City, 66 East 4th Street. In the village. La Mama's a 56-year-old, started by Ellen Stewart, a genius, 56 years ago, major venue for international work as well as American work on the cutting edge. So they were brave enough. They were brave enough to say, go for it, you know, and that's where we're doing it.
Well, that's a very cool place. I actually studied theater with someone who was, I think, succeeded Ellen Stewart probably in running La Mama, and it's great that it's still in existence. You know, and that it's hosting this, and it's very convenient to downtown for New Yorkers who, you know, from this wonderful account will no doubt want to go see this play and take advantage of this wonderful opportunity. I mean, that's just fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about the cast of the play, like
sure.
who's appearing
sure.
in it?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, my partner who runs with me, Theater 3 Collaborative, so we're the originators of the play and we're producing it. La Mama's producing us, Theater 3 Collaborative, is George Bartenieff, who has been called many times an American treasure. He's a four-time Obie Award winner. He's a Broadway, off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway actor. People have seen him on Law & Order. People have seen him everywhere. He's an amazing, profound actor, and as I say, a national treasure. Rocco Sisto, who's playing the lead scientist, is also a four-time Obie Award winner, Broadway, off-Broadway actor, major Shakespearean actor. The two of them were last seen in the Bacchae in Central Park in a production directed by Joanne Acolytis. Those are the two sort of, most famous people in the cast and wonderful people in the cast. The others are a young woman named Emma Rose Krause, who's 22, who comes to us from Oklahoma. She did the reading of the play at her college in Oklahoma that Katie Davis, a theater professor, staged after she read the play. She wrote me and asked me if she could do it with her students. I said, of course. And Emma Rose is just wonderful, a totally unique young woman performer. This is her New York City debut. And then Dee Pelletier has been on Broadway in August, Osage County, and in many off-Broadway shows and regional theaters. Clea Strauss Rivera has been all over the country in Irene Fornes plays and at La Mama many times. And Chris Lewin is, again, a New York actor who has worked a lot off-Broadway. So it's a very high-level cast, and I must say of an extremely lovely cast of people. And so I'm very proud and pleased with them. And then we work with the same designers for many years. So Sally Ann Parsons, our costume designer, is a Tony Award winner for excellence in theater. Tony Giovanetti is a Bessie Award winner and has been all over the world designing lights, came with us to Paris. Our set designer, Gianmarco Laforte. There are lots of Italians, you might notice, in this group. Rocco, me, Tony, Gianmarco, sort of fun. Anyway, they all have a long list of awards, and Carissa Kelly, who's also working on costumes, again, has done a lot of independent films. She's a young person. Arthur Rosen, who's written our beautiful musical score, works with us. This is the fourth play he's written music for us. So it's a team.
You know, so you really kind of have a sort of ensemble for this that's really come together and to whom this speaks. Because, you know, this is, I mean, I love the fact that you're also showing the human side and the natural side. Because what we hear a lot about is the science and policy side, which, of course, is the turnkey place where all this must meet in order to, intervene successfully in this terrible, terrible trajectory. And yet, for that to happen, a lot depends upon we as humans and our ability to engage, our ability to dialogue, the challenges that we face, to our own sense of self, of our world, of belonging, of family, and all of that can really, you know, I mean, that's really how we manage on that side is one way that really either, you know, allows us or in some way blocks or inhibits or stalls the ability to really kind of grasp this and take action. And then on the other side, we have nature, you know, which is both the source of everything, really, as you point out, the source of art, the source of everything, but also is, you know, kind of turning adverse to us in response, you know, to what's unfolding that we have allowed. You know, what do audiences say about the play and how it impacts them?
You know, Jim Hansen, when he saw it, said he said it's really good, and he said he said maybe this play can have an impact, you know, on people, on a wide number of people. And he also said he said the love of nature is the most important part. You can't work to save the planet unless you love nature. So he was very struck by that, and he was very struck. He said the young girl, Annie, is so moving. She becomes a favorite character for many people in the play because she calls herself intersex. She's completely gender fluid, and she's taking care of a frog who's become a hermaphrodite because of atrazine. And she identifies, she says, Sniffly and I have a profound cross-species bond. And her story with the frog is incredibly moving and also funny and also charming. So she really reaches across species boundaries. And lots of people, Alexander Schlutz, who is an eco-critic who wrote the essay about the book in my, who wrote the essay about the play that is in the book, Plays in Time, talks about the importance of cross-species interaction, of putting a frog, putting a frog at the center of a play so that he becomes a major character. Even though, of course, it's not a real frog, but we all think of him as real because he's brought to life by the language of the play and by the activities of the characters. Jennifer Francis, the climate scientist, the Arctic climate scientist, who was one of the first scientists to discover that the Arctic ice melt elongates the jet stream, and that is creating the extreme weather events that we're seeing now in the Northern Hemisphere. And that is, you know, we're affecting the most populous and also prosperous parts of the globe. And you would think then that people wake up when Houston gets flooded, when, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, so that's her theory, and that's in the play, Rebecca, the young Arctic ice scientist. That is her theory. She discovers that. So Jennifer, when she saw the play, just said she's seen it a couple of times. She said there's so much science and so much humanity in the play. And she loved that mix of science and humanity, so that the science, and this is why the play may be important, there's science in it, but it's fed to you as a story. And of course, people love stories. We are the storytellers of the universe. That's what we do. If we have a reason to exist, it's to tell the story of the universe. So this play speaks to our love of storytelling, and the science just gets into you because it's part of the story.
That's invaluable because, I mean, I think that's the big problem we have, the enormity of all of this. You know, when we read the scientific reports and we read them over and over again, you know, it's like and feel disempowered or incompetent or overwhelmed in dealing with it, then people do shut down. You know, it's like hard to keep being presented with the abuse of the planet, really, over and over.
I teach environmental justice at John Jay College for criminal justice in the city. And this year, you know, when we did the play in 2014, we were full of hope because mm-hmm. the Pope had just been to town with his climate encyclical, which he delivered at the UN. The climate mm-hmm. march was happening. There were, 450,000 of us on the streets, and mm-hmm. Paris was in the future. And mm-hmm. so we were hopeful, and Obama was still president, although his energy policies can be critiqued harshly. They're nothing like what we have now. I mean, mm-hmm. the incredible pushback. So one thought, we could change things. Now, mm-hmm. in 2018, we don't have that hope anymore. Mm-hmm. We need to work without hope. We need to work because we need to work in order to keep ourselves alive and the planet alive, and because things change on a dime. You never know. When the consciousness will become universal or almost universal. So it's a very different moment that we're doing this play. But when I teach the environmental justice last semester and this semester, I thought, my God, how can I just give these kids the bad news. No, I mm-hmm. have to put art into this. So I teach Octavia Butler, I teach poetry, eco-poetry, and I teach now this play. And because, the young people already know the bad news.
That's true.
They know it. What they need to know is that the older people get it, and that mm-hmm. there's a history of resistance, and that they can pull on their own imaginations. So my students also make eco-art. They have an option of doing a research paper or doing an eco-art project. So they become enlivened by using their own creativity to apply to the project. And we talk a lot about, if we can change, and we know we can change, and we can get off eating meat every day, we can get off using straws, using plastic bottles, we can recycle, da-da-da. If we can change, that's not going to solve the problem. But it's going mm-hmm. to teach us that we can change, and therefore other people can change. We are mm-hmm. changeable. And that mm-hmm. is what we need to go on. That's the energy we need to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And that is
that makes
also,
complete sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Without it being like, if we all change and become peace-loving people, it will instantly transmit to everyone everywhere, and then this all will abruptly stop. I mean, that could happen.
But it's not bloody likely, is it? Yeah. Yeah.
No.
But it. I mean, the point is, we have to live our own lives, and we have to live with integrity our own lives. We
yes.
have to create a satisfying life for ourselves. And
mm-hmm.
and that does radiate out.
Yes.
That does
mm-hmm.
radiate out. And all through history, what has mattered when you look back at history, it's the people who dared to make a difference that we remember.
Mm-hmm.
And we have,
mm-hmm.
we honor and we go to for sustenance.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, part of, this is the moment.
That's very true. I also feel that, we all, in our heart of hearts, have to live with ourselves, moment by moment and over time. And so,
mm-hmm.
Working for something constructive and being in integrity with that and owning up to the parts of ourselves that are not in integrity without, having a punishing attitude about it,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
also gives us greater tolerance and understanding that everybody is where they are.
Absolutely.
But if we kind of sail our ship, by the path of what we feel is highest integrity, then that also gives tremendous sustenance even, for participating and doing the step by step, even though we can't for certain predict the outcome. And that confers it's a way of blessing your own life, really.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
To give yourself
Absolutely.
That gift. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is just so exciting and wonderful. I hope this next question, which kind of, now that we've gone to the lofty, it's going
uh-huh.
to sound a little gossipy, but I have to ask it because, in my reporting, I have seen the inside of many different industries. I have been in the media for decades. I've seen the inside of the media. I'm not just receiving the information as if it was God's own truth, you know, having been on the inside and seeing how things operate, the same with PR, with marketing, with news, with publishing, with books, you know. And, I mean, I would say I don't really know the art world or the music world that well, but, you know, and of course the gas and oil industry, the food industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and these other industries that I you know, kind of alert people about and critique in my reporting. But I really don't know about the world of theater. And so what you briefly shared, you know, about theater, well, of course it makes complete sense when you said it. Oh, you know, the people who make the decisions about what the public will see are influenced by investors, donors, corporate owners, people in money. This is across the board in our society. Why would it not be so in theater? But I had never actually specifically thought about it. You know, so just as a kind of a bit of a tangent to what we've been talking about, how do you, as a playwright, clearly grappling with the most deeply important issues facing humanity, you know, what is your take on the usual kind of range or messages that, you know, theater in our time will encompass and what it won't encompass? I would love to hear that because, you know, I'm aware of it in these other areas, but not in theater, and I'd love to hear that because all of this shapes what people feel, what they believe, what they think is important. It's not insignificant. So it's not just about censoring one play or one topic. It's about the overall messaging that we get mm-hmm. about what's going on mm-hmm. in our culture. So mm-hmm. I would love to hear your insights into that.
Okay. So since, I mean, that's a huge question, and it is a mm-hmm. little, anyway, let me go mm-hmm. out on a limb for a little bit. But since the McCarthy era, you know, before, in between 2000 and, I mean, sorry, 1934 and 1939, this country had a federal theater project that was run by a magnificent woman named Hallie Flanagan, and it was part of the WPA project. And federal theater was in every state in the country. They did classical plays, religious plays, new plays, old plays. They did a lot of engaged political plays. They created the Living Newspaper Forum to deal with the housing crisis, to deal with energy, a play called Power, to deal with a lot of hot-button issues of the time. They did anti-war plays. They had women playwrights. Susan Glasspell was a playwright. I mean, they did amazing work. It was the first WPA project to be censored by Congress. The Federal Theater was cut in 1939 on the grounds that it was communist, right? And the story is told in Hallie Flanagan's book Arena, which should be a must-read for anybody interested in the American theater. So that's that. Then after that came the Hollywood blacklist, and I was a friend of John Howard Lawson's, who was one of the, and he was a communist. He was, you know, I didn't certainly agree with everything he said, especially on Stalin, but he was a non-repentant American communist, and he did a year in jail because he refused to testify before HUAC. He and the Hollywood Ten. There were others. So once the Hollywood blacklist was put into effect, and so many people caved, and so many other people were silenced, including Yip Harburg for a long time, Pete Seeger for a long time. I mean, major artists. The theater took a turn to domesticity, and mm-hmm. so our theater is mainly represented by feuds within the family, father-son mm-hmm. feuds, you know, families mm-hmm. bickering, and there's no social surround. There's no, mm-hmm. you don't understand why, you know, any of this, I mean, beyond just people are like this. People are like this. They fight with each other. Families are messy. You know, that's the focus, and that remains the focus today. So, you know, now we have plays about, you know, about different kinds of groups, African Americans within the family, Muslim families, gay families. You know, we have a lot of family dramas, and we've expanded in terms of it's no longer the white family or the Jewish family, or even the Italian family. It's other non-traditional families. That's good. That's very good. But the basic tenet remains the same. So what gets is family drama without a social context. So what gets censored in the theater is anything that tries to do what Ibsen tried to do, or what Brecht tried to do, or what Euripides tried to do, which is to put the human drama in a context of larger issues. So anything that deals with the Middle East, especially Israel-Palestine, gets censored. I've been censored. I have friends who have been censored by major theaters in New York who won't touch this subject. Anything that has to do with coming up against the big money interests gets censored. I was told by a major theater in this city that they'd already done one play about the environment, so why should they do another? And that play that they did was funded by the National Institutes of Health. It wasn't funded by the theater itself. And I've been told that my work is too risky to be done. And, you know, and I'm not the only one. So anything that tries to, like James Baldwin, for instance, who I teach his wonderful play Blues for Mr. Charlie, which tries to look at American racism from the black perspective but also from the white perspective. So he puts good old white racists on the stage, and he tries to tell their drama and their story and how this interacts. And he unmasks all the lies that lead to racism, you know, the lies about African American people, about black people, and that the white community tells over and over and over. At the same time, they're doing something else. They're raping black women. They're going into black communities and shooting them up. They're telling the lie that black people are violent, that black men want to rape white women. You know, they're telling the lies. So he unmasks all of that. He, too, had a very hard time in the American theater, and he finally gave it up and just started writing novels. And he's one of our major writers, Baldwin. So everyone who's attempted go into a larger direction, my friend Naomi Wallace, my friend Kia Cothran, wonderful playwrights, both of them have come up against these issues over and over again. My play about the Iraq War, my play about the U.S. torture program, these are subjects that are, you know, verboten. And we've had to do them really on the down low. we've had, you know, in the small theaters, the adventurous theaters, often selling. George and I sold a cabin that we owned to support one of the plays. I mean, really, really on very low budgets. You know, so that's what it is. It's just the censorship happens by cutting off the money, and the money is cut off to any play that would try to really grapple with the individual in a social context, the individual dealing with violence of war, the individual dealing with the environmental crisis. So that's how it works, if that makes sense to you.
It makes complete sense to me because I'll just share. I had this experience of being in a place where, you know, because I am a writer and I've written books I write in many different media and stuff like that. I had an opportunity to actually work in a bookstore, a local community bookstore. This is several years back, and I thought, well, that will be interesting to see the whole thing from the point of, you know, from sales, from a community, you know, and all of that, what people are reading, who reads what, you know. I belong to the food co-op in Brooklyn, and I was a checkout and cashier person.
Me too.
Oh, you do? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm retired, but I've belonged for, you know, 40 years. Since it started, I've been a member. Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I shop there.
Oh, we've probably seen each other shopping.
But,
it, you know, it's real. So for me, like, because I'm a foodie, a food policy person, you know, a food advocacy person, to see who buys what food at the co-op, you know, who's eating what and how do they look, you know, all of that, you know, and the connection to health. So I'm always interested in actually, because also I think my grandmother was a saleswoman in a store and all of that, you know, it feels like kind of basic groundedness to me to do that. So I did it in a bookstore, and I encountered exactly what you were describing in the novels. You know, all of the novels were
absolutely
about the personal travails of this one or that one, or exactly the way you described it. I won't even repeat it. And, you know, everybody was reading this one and that one, and all these people came in, and they'd get four or five of them. And I found them very dull. I wasn't interested in these small stories that were actually seemed very I mean, I did read some of them that were the most popular, and they seemed very ungrounded when you read them, because all of what you're describing was absent. And, you know, I gravitated naturally in any case, you know, to history and, you know, and all of that, because, you know, that fascinates me, and that, you know, how we all got here.
You have to go outside of the U.S. In every other country in the world, theater and fiction have been the way that you bring the news. You bring the news of the time in which you live. And in every other country in the world, virtually, people see individuals as part of a web of historical, social, economic forces. They don't see us alone in the universe and living in our condos. You know, American fiction and American drama does, you know, again, there are those of us who try to buck this system, but we are cast aside, and many of us are women, and so we're cast aside, you know, it's easier to cast us aside, but we're kept out of the club, and the club is self-congratulatory and insular, and I think that is true also of fiction. It's also true.
And I think it also translates into films, because in the very same community, you know, if you go to the films, it's this one introducing, you know, someone of a different ethnic background into their family. Just as you say, these family-based or romantically-based, you know, they came together even though they were of different backgrounds. You know, yes, this is important in people's lives, but the whole context for, you know, why this is so difficult, you know, it's always the individual and the family and their particular stories. And the lens never widens out. And, you know, and it's the same story, actually,
so
you know, over and over again.
Life makes no sense. This is why we have an opioid epidemic, a depression, suicide epidemic. This is why, you know, life makes no sense unless you see yourself connected to larger forces, and those are natural forces and historical forces. And when you locate yourself in that moment, you begin to understand why you're this way, why the world is this way, where, you know, how you can operate. And of course, the great writers have always known that. As I say, you go out of the American tradition into the European tradition or the African tradition or the Asian tradition, and suddenly you see people in the world, and you have fate and gods and huge forces that are pushing against people, and these are, you know, this is really what life is like. We call the American tradition realism, but it's not realism. it's absent from the real, you know, which is the, and with the Anthropocene, of course, we're going to see this. We are little creatures. We have created a world out of balance and out of whack, and it is going to come back and impact us. And we have to figure out how to maintain ourselves in that with forces much larger than we are, that we have created but we don't control. That's really the powerful story of Extreme Weather, and also of the new play, Other Than We, which is a totally different. I love this new play. I hope we can get it done. We have no idea how we'll ever find the money or support, even though people who've read it and people who've heard the first reading were wildly enthusiastic, beyond my wildest dreams enthusiastic. But the new play sort of gives a... It's funny and human and visionary at the same time, and it gives a kind of look at what we're up against, but in a way that's very engaging. Anyway, but it's hard. It's hard.
No, I totally. Yeah. Your work is really, really important, because, you know, on the one hand, we kind of tighten the lens in on the individual family, and we don't want to talk about all of those other things. But that means also that there's no resource. I think you're, you know, so if there's a problem, you know, where
there's
do you get resources?
There's
it's
no history. You know, there's no sense of the grandeur of life, really, because, I mean, the Greeks did it by the gods. Here we are facing, you know, the pantheon of the gods, but the gods are really, you know, the huge forces and emotions that both operate inside us, like eros and madness, and outside us, like war, you know, and the ocean, et cetera, the forces. And we have to locate ourselves always in, you know, in the midst of a larger story. And to change anything, you have to know the larger story. You have to know how you're positioned and how we are positioned today. If we didn't know that the climate deniers were lying and that they're funded to lie, until we knew that, it was very confusing, you know. Where are these people coming from? This is a meteorologist from MIT, and he's saying climate change doesn't exist. Global warming is a hoax. You know, oh, he's funded by, you know, he's funded by the Koch brothers. Oh, now it begins to make sense. You know, now the Mercers, the Koch. I mean, you look at the Koch brothers' funding. Greenpeace has done this. Who's in office? You know, who? Why do we have a climate denying Congress? Because they're all funded by the fossil fuel industry. You can just look at their, you know, who funds their campaigns, the NRA and the fossil fuel industry.
With a little help from the pharma industry.
Absolutely. Let us not forget. Yes.
And the food industry.
And Monsanto. You know, yes. Right.
Right. Exactly. You know I'm glad you mentioned the Anthropocene, because I was kind of trying to figure out how we could weave around to that. You know, it is actually the work of the kind of art you're doing, to help people place people in their web, in their landscape, and to help us make sense of where we belong and are in the greater scheme of things.
It
sounds like Extreme Weather, which, by the way, folks, is going to be playing for the next 3 weekends in New York City, beginning March 1st at La Mama. LAMAMA. You can go online and look for that and attend it. So that is a natural work of that form. At the same time, you know, what we've been talking about, which is this myopically too close and disconnected focus on an individual's family, on the romantic story, all of that done and repeated and repeated and repeated, also in a sense inflates the role of the human. You know, what's going on in the human, what's going on in the human psyche, and then we are not only then ill-prepared to address this global threat to life, including for our own species, but we also forget that there are many other species to whom we are connected. And I love the fact that you have a frog as a character in the play, because many of us have animals, companion animals, whom we love more, sometimes more than humans, and for good reason, you know. You know, so I'd love to hear your perspective on the Anthropocene, because I find that people aren't that aware of that lens through which we look at things.
Yeah, well, this play, Extreme Weather, has an epilogue that addresses two possibilities for the Anthropocene. The next play, Extreme Weather, the next play, Other Than We, is actually set after the deluge. And it's about the creation of a new species capable of living in the Anthropocene, not only physically living in the Anthropocene, so they have adaptabilities that are necessary for a world that's scarce with water and food, et cetera, but they're really part Homo sapiens and part animals. I mean, they're beyond. They take the next leap beyond Homo sapiens into another kind of creature. And the story is the effort to give birth to this new species. The big thing is that the head is connected to the heart. That in the new species they cannot act just by the intellect. And the heart is not disconnected from the intellect. The two are connected, so that everything they do is organically coming from a holistic perspective. This is, to put it one way. And it's both about the effort of birth, which women know very well, and men are beginning to know better, that we sacrifice. We put our lives on the line every time we give birth, right? Giving birth is the only act of heroism. We talk about heroism in warriors who go off to kill, but actually giving birth is when you put your life on the line in order to create another life.
right.
And this is heroic. This is heroic in a large sense, in a very real sense. But it's, of course, it's been diminished. So the heroic effort to give birth to a new species that could live in the Anthropocene, and live in the Anthropocene also with humility, there's a speech in Extreme Weather. There's a moment where John, the scientist, freaks. He believes we've reached the tipping point. And it's over. And, of course, everybody's waiting for that moment, right? I mean, we're so close to it in so many climate systems. What is the, you know, when does the last huge cave of the ice happen? When does the sea level rise, you know, however many meters, and we're, you know, the coastal cities are under. What is the tipping point for life as we know it now, which we're sort of tenuously clinging to? Anyway, so he believes we've reached the tipping point. And he has to deal with that. He has to deal with the fact that all of his intelligence and all of our intelligence has brought us here. It hasn't avoided it. It's actually got us here. And how then do you go on? And how do you sort of reconfigure yourself and to continue on in a much more frail and humble way? We're not at the center of the universe. We're no longer the drivers of the universe, of the Earth, right? We're back to being conscious, very conscious beings in a world that we don't control, and that is that in a way has that in a way has been our position always. If we had known that earlier, we wouldn't be in this situation we're in right now.
We're going to have to end the program soon, but I think that I love that we're in that position now, but we don't know it, and then a play can represent that in a way that brings us in touch with that. So I just, it's been so wonderful having you here on Connect the Dots, Karen Malpede, and I hope listeners that you will, if you're in the New York metro area, go see Karen's new production of Extreme Weather, a cli-fi play that she has written and directed that will be presented at La Mama beginning this week, March 1st, and for the next 3 weekends. I'm going to be looking forward very much to seeing it. I hope to see other friends and listeners there as well. Thank you so much, Karen, for your extraordinary work, your deep and caring insight, and this play, which I can't wait to see, and for being with us today and sharing your wisdom here on Connect the Dots.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you so much. Thank you for what you do. Thank you.
Well, we've
been
part
great
of the same
talking
team.
With, great talking yeah, with you. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, maybe we'll I'll see you at the play, and maybe
you
at
will.
The co-op.
You will. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. Go see the play, Extreme Weather. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And if Extreme Weather isn't in your area and you're part of any kind of theater company or group or donor group that would like to see it come to your area, please reach out to Karen Malpede, and then you can maybe participate in having it staged somewhere near you.
The book is available on Amazon. I hate to push Amazon. It's also available from the University of Chicago. It's called Plays in Time, and it has the script of Extreme Weather in it.
Fantastic. Well, that's for all of the directors and producers and theater organizers out there. Thank you again, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.